This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
Getting ready for a big Thanksgiving scientific experiment.
Oh, yes, I see. This could be some fun.
Oh, yes. We'll talk about the physics of cooking a turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And I may get into how to make gravy without lumps. These are some very simple ideas that that we teach in actually in our food science class there at Stratford University in the culinary arts program.
I like when we do food science.
Yes, we always do a little food science around Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a cyber attack on a pump station. You know, we talked about how you can access these devices that control pumps and valves and things over the internet. And
we're talking like public utility things.
Public utilities.
So people understand.
Actually, this was a pump in a there was a pump in a sewage system.
Oh boy!
And so I'll get into this what they did and what the vulnerabilities are. But the attacker was a little bit teed off because he actually penetrated one site and then DHS said, well, we don't think it's a real penetration. And he got so teed off that he penetrated another site and published all of his results on the web just to say, no, it is a penetration. So we'll go through that. And that actually brings up a major weakness in our overall infrastructure in terms of protecting things.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk a bit about the GPS problem. There are, you know, you've heard about this broadband internet where they want to use some unused spectrum, which is very close to the spectrum used by the GPS system. And so there is a problem and a fear that it will interfere with GPS and then we won't have GPS functioning very well. And I'll go through some of the vulnerabilities that GPS has. And then I'm going to get into something, so that will be a segue into the politics of spectrum allocation. Because there's an interesting thing because policy decisions that are made have long-term implications over what kind of technology can be deployed. We'll get into that. And the man we're going to feature in Profiles NIT was the founder of the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, and he was one of the internet pioneers. He's not really a computer scientist. He has a degree in psychology.
Ah.
But he's a visionary, and he's a leader of technologists. So he actually had quite an impact on the internet and during the formative stages. And, of course, it was a huge, huge mailbag. In fact, it's two mailbags.
I noticed.
Two mailbags.
It's, you know, the mail guy had to come twice. Do I have to do this twice?
Yes, it is. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
There's for the second one. Oh, wait,
yes.
He went away already. He figured he gets paid to do that once per show.
That's it. It's a union deal.
Exactly.
It's a union deal. Now, we have a Facebook post by Kenneth Hutchison.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kenneth said, Wikipedia says that LISP, L-I-S-P, stands for list processing rather than list programming. And you gave the wrong information on the show 2 weeks ago.
Does that mean we have to take the prize back?
No.
It might be tough
at
this point.
No. Actually, it turned out that Jim from Bowie had the correct answer, and I corrected him with the wrong answer. And so Ken said, you know, Dr. Schertz, that is the wrong answer.
He
got right on that. You know, so I thought I would just come. Whenever I make a mistake, I like to just come right out with it.
I like that about you. And it's so infrequently that happens.
This is list processing. It's a programming language, LISP, and it's used for artificial intelligence. It's probably its dominant application because you've got a whole set of rules, like a list of rules, and you process those rules, and so list processing is used for that. But so Jim of Bowie had exactly the correct answer.
We should send him something.
Well, we did. Even though I told him he was almost right, and I gave him a correction. We did send him the prize.
That's right.
But actually, he was totally right.
He was. I think we should give Kenneth something.
Yeah, maybe we should do that. I think that's a very good idea. Then we have another Facebook post from James Messick. If you haven't done a profile on Robert Taylor, the founder of Xerox PARC, I think that'd be a good one.
Well, gee, guess what?
And James,
that could happen in just moments.
That is a great suggestion. And in fact, when I did some work on Robert, he's got an interesting story, and I had not done Robert before, and so that was a fantastic suggestion. I love those kind of suggestions. We got an email from Good and Fair. Now, as opposed from Fair and Balanced.
Right.
We got an email from Good and Fair.
I'm leaning forward here, by the way.
Okay.
Listening to the left.
Dr. Richard Schertz. It's a very formal email.
Yes, it is.
I use Windows Live Mail for about 8 different email accounts, mostly Verizon accounts and one Hotmail account. And I mainly use the Quick View so I can have all my emails dumped into one inbox. I'm now getting an error which says an unknown error has occurred. And when I try to delete a group of emails, as I've done successfully in the past, I can't delete them. But before I could delete them, has anybody else had this kind of error? Thanks. Bethesda Female Regular Listener.
That's a funny name.
Yes. Tech Talk responds.
Dr. Richard Church.
Dr. Richard Church responds. Well, actually, several users have reported this problem, and the problem is caused by a number of different things, and it depends on your particular situation. The posts on this particular problem date all the way back to 2009. I went, by the way, to WindowsLiveHelp.com. That is a discussion group devoted strictly to Windows Live problems. So it's WindowsLiveHelp.com. Now, the solutions were many. Many of them said you've got to upgrade to the latest version of Windows Live. Some said there's a problem with Fox Pro, and in that case, you have to upgrade to the latest version of Fox Pro. Some people with Vista had to install the latest service pack. And so it really depended on what your situation was. But there's kind of a theme here. Get the latest version of whatever you happen to be using. There was also another solution where apparently the counters became corrupted, and they gave directions on where you could go offline, go in there, reset the counters. You could delete the emails, go back to the subdirectories, actually delete the emails, then put it back on live again, and it would reset and start up without any problems. So I don't really have enough information from Good and Fair to know exactly what the specific problem is, but I would recommend that you go to WindowsLiveHelp.com to work on your specific problem. And just search for that particular error message, and you'll get all of the responses relating to that. We got an email from Led by Brain. It's a regular listener. We get emails from Led by Brain quite frequently. Dr. Richard Schertz. This is another very formal presentation. I've been doing research on the purchase of my next PC.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a smart, computer-savvy friend recommends these brands, Acer, HP, Asus, Toshiba. I mean, those are all of the cheapest versions of notebooks that you could get, and they're certainly all reliable. And so if you want to go for the low-end version of a laptop, those would all be excellent brands for you. And I've actually used 3 of those 4 mm-hmm. over the course of my career. Now, I'm going to buy either at Amazon or Newegg. Now, when I go to Amazon, I find laptops, tablets, netbooks, computers, and Chromebooks, netbooks, ultrabooks. I have no appreciation on how to compare these types of PCs. So she's confused by laptops, tablets, netbooks, Chromebooks, ultrabooks. She wants around 500 gigabytes of hard drive and about 4 gigs of RAM. She wants a 17-inch screen. That's a very big screen.
That is.
That's a very big screen.
That'll be a heavy machine, won't it?
Yeah, that will be a heavy machine. I have no need to be traveling with the PC. I've actually been using my laptop as a desktop for years, and weight is not an issue. I don't do games. I don't do store pics. I don't store pictures. Mainly I do MS Office. I do email. I use it some bookkeeping. I've upgraded to MS Office 210 on the machine. And I'm wondering, and I also have this problem, how am I going to put my Microsoft Office on the new machine? But I don't have any CD to install it. I suppose I bought a download version earlier. Thanks, fan of Dr. Schertz et al.
She could burn that to CD, couldn't she?
Well, she could. You could. Well, you can actually just download the program. Okay. So first of all, I think that you don't need to get a netbook or any kind of small one.
They're awful, aren't they?
Yeah,
way too slow.
For your application, you can get any of these Acer, HP, Asus, Toshiba. Any of them are just fine. I just get the and the specs that you've given are very standard specs for these machines. And I would just get one where you like the look and the feel of it. You like the feel of the keyboard. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd actually try them out. I'd go in one of the big box stores and just try it out, see if you like how it feels. There are differences in displays in terms of how bright they are, and you might want to look at the display. Just get something that you like the ergonomic. Any of those brands are fine. Now, as far as your software, you need to have the product, the key. You need to have the license key. That's basically a code. You can go to the software about and you look at it. It will give you the license key in there. If you go into there's a drop down thing called about, and then you can go into the version and it'll give you the key. You can look that up. And so you want to make certain that you get that key, because you can't install the new software without the key. Then what you want to do is you want to go to Microsoft.com/office/downloads, and you can download your Microsoft Office.
Mm-hmm.
And they've actually got Microsoft Office 210 up there. You can just download it. You download the full version of it. But before they let you download it, you have to enter in your key. So you enter in the key, you download it, and you can install it. So you'll have no trouble at all, you know, transferring this to the new machine, as long as you have that key.
Yeah.
So that's very valuable. We have an email from Robert Tyler.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Robert Tyler, dear Dr. Schertz, I've been reading about hacker groups attacking companies' websites, in some cases the company's internet systems, via distributed denial of service attacks. My question is not about distributed denial of service attacks per se. It's rather how do IT departments protect themselves against DDoS attacks, and how do they recover when they have been attacked in that way? Thanks again for a great podcast that you and your team produce each week. I've learned so much over the past few years. I hope you realize, and I know you do that, what a quality podcast it is.
Well,
thanks,
that's
Robert
why we do it.
That is exactly why we do it. Well, I'll tell you what distributed denial of service attacks are. Let me have a sidebar. So I can just explain what it means. Many of these hackers go out and they have bots that they install. These are basically malicious programs that they install on machines that haven't been fully patched. And they can communicate with these bots through very simple codes and commands. And it's basically a network of bots. And what they can do is they can direct all of these bots, and there might be a million of those bots or 500,000 of those bots available, you know, of infected machines out on the internet, and they could direct them all to start sending packets of information to a particular website. And they basically swamp the website. It just can't respond to so much incoming traffic. And it's very hard to block this traffic because it's coming from a million different locations all over the internet, a lot of different IP addresses. And if they try to block all of those IP addresses and all of that traffic from everywhere, you end up just shutting down the site anyway because you're just almost blocking it all. So it's very hard to protect against distributed denial of service attacks. And these have been used frequently against, say, e-commerce sites. If they want to blackmail, say, the week before Christmas, they want to blackmail a particular vendor who's doing online sales, they could bring down his site with a distributed denial of service attack and wait for him to pay them something. So it's been used like that in the past. Or it's also been used in times for political reasons. If you uh, if you object to something that a government did or a store did, it was used for political reasons. But in all cases, it's a malicious activity that's designed to bring down the service. And it's called denial of service because the machine is so overswamped that it cannot deliver service to a legitimate user. And it's called distributed because it's coming from multiple sites. Now, the only way to protect against this is, number one, you would want to have a high capacity on your servers. And if you have high capacity on the servers with, you know, multi-cores, you might be able to take a limited amount of denial of service attack. That would be step number one, would be to basically try to, you know, control your provisioning and so that you've got enough provisions to handle it. Second thing, you want to monitor, the companies want to monitor their websites. You can monitor your website, and you can actually compute the response time of your website. So if in case anything begins to happen, you get immediate notification so that you can start looking at how you are provisioning services on that server. Like, for instance, it might be that you're so much traffic's coming in that your log file fills up and you got to dump your log file. So you may have to do some certain things to keep the server up and running. You also may want to go to some of the upstream providers that are sending the traffic to you, and they can configure their routers to detect certain types of packets that are actually coming in there and trying to bring down your site. And they can actually, by many of the packets have spoofed IP addresses, and they can detect spoofed IP addresses, and they can then block that packet. So there are certain ways that they can configure their routers. So you want to be friendly with your upstream provider. Now, probably the most effective way to do it is using a protocol called IP Anycast. Now, IP Anycast allows you to distribute the load. Now, it's actually an internet standard that allows for global mirroring of critical resources. And so when you use Anycast, identical server names advertise the same IP address from multiple strategically distributed locations. So if something's coming to that particular IP address, it's going to go to the server which is closest to the person generating it, and that allows you to spread the load all over the internet. And if there are there's a lot of traffic hitting particular just one server, then it might bring down your service for just part of the internet, but not the whole internet. So IP Anycast is actually probably the most effective way to do it, and some of the large vendors use that. And certainly the domain name system, all the name servers, all the DNS name servers, which are really the backbone of the internet, they're all using IP Anycast in order to protect themselves against it. And we got an email from Snake Eyes.
Uh-oh.
Dear Dr. Schertz, I've had Verizon Fios Internet for many years, and before that, Verizon DSL, over 11 years combined. And I always have them just bill my American Express bill, and I just pay it online. But the entry that they give me is very brief, and I got no meaningful information as to, you know, what the charges are for. Now I'm getting monthly bills, and it doesn't even show me the billing period or what kind of level of service I have. And, you know, I'm not very happy with that bill, and I just don't want to have to call Verizon help desk because I don't like calling or trying to talk to anybody at their help desk. It's too hard to get through.
Help, no help desk.
Yeah, what do you recommend? By the way, I do like Fios. It's a very reliable fiber service. Well, I would set up an online Verizon account.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have Verizon, and, you know, the paper bill is a pain to look at, but you can go to your online account. So you just go to Verizon.com, and your online portal is going to be my.verizon.com, and you just set up your username and password. Now, the first time you go in there, you're going to have to give them your account number or your phone number, or both, and they will then you give them your email address, and you'll have some challenge words there, and you can set up your account, and then you can then, once you have your account set up, you can look at all your billing. You can also, once through your account, you can change your level of service. You can look at what you have, and if you want to change it, upgrade it, downgrade it, you can do it all right online, and you don't have to talk to anyone. Now, one of the interest, and when you go online, you can look at even all the phone numbers that you've been calling. One interesting thing is that it's fairly easy to set up an account for somebody else. Like, and this is how a lot of this uh, this phone hacking got set up. You know, so if you haven't set up your account and somebody would just happen to see your bill, for instance, or they knew your phone number, they could possibly go in and set up a brand new account trying to impersonate you, and then they could look at your whole account information. And so this is one of the very frequent ways that that the news media has been getting access to phone logs doing that. So So anyway, very good email. We had great emails this week.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, I went out and talked to the mailbag guy, and I said, I told him to come back here.
Okay.
Because we pay him by the hour, right?
Yeah, we do.
And he needs to be available whenever we need
that
him.
That is
so
first.
Don't leave until we tell you.
Yes, very good.
Uh-huh. Hey, you know something? You mentioned one of our letters was a Facebook posting.
Yeah.
How
so
do we get to Facebook?
Go to facebook.com/techtalkonline. And I'm going to be monitoring that account during the show to see whether anybody's making any comments.
Very good. You are listening to your classroom of the airwaves, Tech Talk Radio, heard on 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. Stand by. Lots more coming up here on Tech Talk.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University. Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge of Stratford University talking technology. Now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes. Today we're going to be talking about Robert William Taylor. Robert William Taylor is an internet pioneer. He's the founding manager of the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, called PARC, P-A-R-C. He's the founder of the DEC Systems Research Center. That would be the Digital Equipment Corporation Systems Research Center. He was also director of ARPA's Information Processing Techniques Office, IPTO. Robert W. Taylor was born in Dallas, Texas in 1932. He was adopted. His father was a Methodist minister, and his family spent a lot of time just traveling around from parish to parish. He started Southern Methodist University at age 16, and he dropped out. He just wasn't actually a serious student in the beginning, and he served a couple of years in the Navy during the Korean War. Then he came back to school and attended University of Texas under the GI Bill. He was sort of what they call a career student. He just took a lot of different classes. He took what he liked. He really wasn't particularly working on a degree, just loved going to school. And he ultimately finally did piece together enough classes to get a bachelor's degree. He got a Bachelor of Science in Experimental Psychology with minors in math, philosophy, English, and religion. That's quite a broad mixture. After he got out of got his degree, he taught math in high school, and he coached basketball at a co-ed prep school in Florida. But he was having money problems because he wasn't earning that much money, and he decided he'd try to go for the big money. So he took an engineering job with an aircraft company, and he got a job with Martin Marietta working on some technology areas. And he was there for a short while, and then he was invited to join NASA in 1961 after he submitted a research proposal for a flight control simulation system. You see, he was really into the man-machine interface because he was a psychologist. That's why he got into this flight control simulation system. NASA liked what and so he started working at NASA. So he moved to Washington, D.C., and he worked for NASA while the Kennedy administration was backing the Apollo program for the manned moon landing. That was a pretty exciting time there. And he stayed with NASA for a couple of years. But then in 1962, he met J.C.R. Licklider, who was head of the New Information Processing Techniques Office at ARPA, Advanced Research Project Agency. And it turned out that Licklider was also a psychologist, and he had done psychoacoustics work, just like Taylor had done. And he wrote an article in 1960, which he envisioned new ways that you could use computers. And they were both kind of interested in this man-machine interface. So they got along really well. So it turned out that Licklider decided to hire Robert Taylor. And he hired him in 1965, and so he moved from NASA to ARPA. And this was at the time when ARPA was trying to grapple with how to set up a resilient network that could actually survive a nuclear attack. This was, you know, this was during the sort of the nuclear
the Cold War era,
and so he wanted to. So he began working on that. Now, and actually, at the time he had contracts with MIT, and he had with Stanford, and multiple contractors, and he would do discussions with each of these research groups, you know, using his terminal. He had a dumb terminal, so he would have to sit down at the MIT terminal, and he could have discussions with the MIT people, but only the MIT people in the MIT terminal. Then if he wanted to talk to somebody from Berkeley, he'd have to get up, sit in the next chair, and sit at the Berkeley terminal and talk to the Berkeley people. And there was no way for him to have the Berkeley people and the MIT people talk with each other. So they said, why don't we just set up a system where I could have one terminal and talk to everybody? This was the beginning of the internet, because it's an internetworking. So each of these three systems were networks, but you bring them together, you internetwork. And this was the beginning of internetworking. And so he was there right at the very beginning. Now, in 1968, Licklider and Taylor published a paper. It was a seminal paper, which was The Computer as a Communication Device, which laid out the future of what the internet would eventually become. You see, at that time, you had a lot of computer scientists looking at bits and bytes and the technology of it. And these guys said, look, eventually the computer technology will be standardized, and it's going to be a communication device. And so they really predicted all of the kinds of things that are going on now on the internet, and almost the technology is secondary to the communication now. And these two psychologists predicted that. He left DARPA. It was called ARPA then, still, in 1969, and he worked for a year at the University of Utah in computer graphics. It was another man-machine interface project. And then in 1970, Xerox brought him out to start a research center in Palo Alto, the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, and they brought him on as a manager. And he was there from 1970 to 1983. And during that time, they assembled probably the most innovative team of researchers in the country, and the impact of what went on in those 13 years is enormous. In that area, they focused on products like personal computers, and they came up with the first personal computer, the Altos. They developed the first graphical user interface, the first mouse. They developed at that place Ethernet, which is the standard one. Bob Metcalf was there. He invented Ethernet. They invented the laser printer. They invented WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get. Fonts on the screen, you print the font, and then it goes to the printer. All of these things were developed at Xerox. But Xerox, of course, was a copying company. So they kind of liked the laser printer, because that became sort of the basis of the copier. But all of these other things they actually didn't take advantage of. Now, others did, like Steve Jobs came down there to park, and he saw for the first time the mouse, the fonts, and he basically used that information for the Macintosh computer. So it actually dramatically altered the path that that Macintosh took. Even Windows and was influenced quite dramatically by the work there, and Microsoft hired quite a few of the other people there. So they actually put people in jobs. They actually many of the people that worked there went on to start other companies, like the Adobe was started by people that were there. It turned out that 3Com was started by Bob Metcalf, was there. So there's a lot of spin out companies, and so it was people go back on that and say, boy, that was really the golden age. And so it turned out that he was an inspirational leader. He was a visionary. He was not a technologist. He was a psychologist, but he knew how to put together people, how to challenge them, and how to get them to do the right thing. In 1983, he got fed up with Xerox, because Xerox was not able to really capitalize on any of these things and use them. And he went to the Digital Equipment Corporation. They asked him to set up a research center for them, and he set up the Systems Research Center in Palo Alto, same place. And while he was there, they basically developed a number of other things. They developed electronic books. They developed modern workstations. They also developed a precursor to the Java programming language. And it's quite a bit of good activity there at that research center. In 1999, Taylor received the National Medal of Technology and Innovation. And that's quite a huge honor. He's won many awards, but this is probably one of the most recent ones. And he said, for visionary leadership in the development of modern computer technology, including computer interfaces, personal computers, and graphical user interface. In 1996, Taylor retired. He lives in Woodside, California. His two large poodles, Max and Laura. He likes to read books, he listens to music, he cooks, he grows tomatoes there. While he sometimes plays computer games, he does not have a cell phone, he does not have a copier, he does not have a fax, he does not have a scanner. He likes to live in a little bit of isolation there. In fact, he was called by the White House in 1999 when he got this National Medal, and they said, we'd like to invite you to the White House for this award ceremony. The medal will be presented by President Clinton. And he said, really, I'm just done with that. You just mail it to me.
Wow.
And so it turns out his son thought maybe they should. So his son went out there along with one of his colleagues, and they received the medal because he was pretty much done with that. Here's a man, and this gets sort of at the core of innovation. You know, you put together people with different backgrounds, so you've got physicists, you've got electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, psychologists. You put them together, and these different backgrounds, you can create sort of the magic sauce for the secret sauce for innovation. He also, when he created this company in Palo Alto, now you look at these companies. What he did now is done quite often in many of these dot-com companies. But he had a room there with all these bean bags, and the guys would go in there. And they only had coffee. They said they had great coffee in there, and they had whiteboards all around the room. And they'd go in there, and they'd sit on these bean bags, and they'd just talk about stuff. And they'd put notes on the wall. And that environment was extremely conducive to innovative thought. And in fact, when Steve Jobs came down there and looked at this research center, he says, you guys, because they were actually years, probably a decade or 15 years ahead of the rest of the area, and they said, this is the kind of environment I like. This is a great kind of company. And he kind of invented that environment. So there's a man who really did make a difference in technology, Robert William Taylor, the founder of Park and an internet pioneer.
Hope you were paying attention, because free food is on the line. We've got the pop quiz coming up next. Your chance to call in and win. The number is 877-936-9333, 877-936-9333. Stand by, the pop quiz and more of Tech Talk coming up here on Federal News Radio.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor, five of the 30 occupations projected to grow the fastest by 2016 are IT-related, led by network and data communications analysts, software engineers, and systems analysts. 70% of business technology professionals surveyed by Information Week say there is a shortage of IT talent in the U.S. today. However, if you have previous military or management experience, there are tremendous opportunities for you in the IT field if you retrain. Stratford University's bachelor's degree in information technology prepares you to analyze, design, implement, administer, and secure computer networks and information systems. Master's degrees are also offered in information systems and software engineering. Day and evening classes are offered so you can continue in your current field. Call Stratford University at 800-444-0804 or visit online at stratford.edu. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, Tyson's Corner in Woodbridge.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the Internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Well, welcome back to the Classroom of the Airwaves, also known as a radio show.
Oh, wow. You're just doing that to mess with me, aren't you?
I certainly am. And, of course, if it's a Classroom of the Airwaves or a Classroom of the Internet, or a classroom of anything, you always have to have a pop quiz. And if there's a pop quiz, it means that you have the potential of getting an A grade if you get the correct answer. But in this case, you get something special. You also get two tickets to fine dining at either the Escoffier Dining Room or at the Carême Dining Room. And very shortly, we'll be at their dining room in Richmond. Those are Escoffier, of course, dining room is run by the Culinary Department at Stratford University at the Falls Church campus. The Carême Dining Room is run by the Culinary Department of Stratford University at our Woodbridge campus. Now, earlier in the show, I was talking about William Taylor, Robert William Taylor. He, of course, founder of Xerox PARC and an internet pioneer. And he was kind of a slow starter. It took him a while to go to school. He would like to take a lot of classes in school. And he finally did get a Bachelor of Science in Experimental Psychology. Now, the question is, can you name one of his minors?
Mm-hmm.
He had four minors, and can you name one of the minors that he had while he was going to school and for a good long while?
Yes. Now, if you have that answer, you cannot drive to the studio and tell us in person because it's an hour show, and we've only got 20-some minutes left. You need to call us, 877-936-9333, 877-936-9333. Once again, 877-936-9333. 9333.
Or you can go on to Skype and go to Tech Talk Radio 1, and if you put through a call to that account, it will be forwarded directly to the studio.
Yes.
You can do that anywhere in the world.
Correct.
Okay, let's talk about this pump failure that may have been caused by a cyber attack. Federal officials confirmed on Friday that they were investigating a cyber attack that may have been responsible for the failure of a water pump at a public district in Illinois last week. Now, such an attack would be noteworthy because while cyber attacks in businesses are commonplace, attacks that penetrate industrial control systems and intentionally destroy equipment are virtually unknown, although they've been talked about as a potential threat in the case of a cyber war. Now, the report says that the water district workers noted glitches in the system for about 2 months. On November 8th, the Water District employee noticed problems with the industrial control systems, and a computer repair company checked the logs and determined that the computer had been hacked. Now, the cyber attacker hacked into the water utility using passwords stolen from a control system vendor, and that he had stolen other usernames and passwords. Now, the Department of Homeland Security said the cause of the water pump is really unknown, and they're gathering facts, and they're not willing to quite determine that, in fact, it was a penetration, although the evidence is strong. Now, the Department of Homeland Security said that the water system is located in Springfield, Illinois. Now, that particular comment by the Department of Homeland Security that they really aren't sure it was a cyber attack just teed off the guy who did the cyber attack. So just yesterday, another system was attacked. Now, this was a water system in Springfield. This was a water system in, this was actually a water and sewer system in the city of South Houston, Texas. And what this hacker did, he hacked into the system and he got onto the control computers that control all of the pumps. And it was the graphical user interface that showed all the pumps. You could turn them on, turn them off. And he actually then took screenshots of those control systems, and he posted all the screenshots to the internet. He said, "See, I was there, and I don't want Homeland Security saying I wasn't there."
Jeez.
Now it was posted by someone calling himself PR0F, Prof.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't like the particular word that there was no credible corroborated data that indicated that there was a critical infrastructure which was at risk. So he is taking it on himself, his mission, to actually penetrate systems, demonstrate that we're vulnerable, so that there's some attention put on it. So this may be actually a good guy who is trying to call attention to it, although he did burn out that pump. That first pump.
That wasn't good.
But the second one, he didn't damage anything. He just proved that he had gone in there. So there you go. We may have our first cyber attack on our infrastructure systems.
Occupy the pump.
Yes.
Hey, this is a good thing. I see new faces in the classroom this morning.
Ah,
so
very
let's
good.
Go to Barbara calling from Arlington on line one. Barbara, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Doc, ask the question, please.
Yes. Earlier in this show, we talked about Robert William Taylor. He, of course, is an internet pioneer, and he got his bachelor's degree in psychology. He majored, had four minors. What were one of his four minors?
One of them was math.
That is correct.
Excellent.
Very good.
Barbara, thanks for calling, and Doc, tell her what she's won.
You win two tickets to fine dining, and you can just stay on the line, give your name and address to Andrew. We'll get those tickets out to you next week.
And Barbara, I haven't really noticed that you've called us before. Is this your first time listening? Or have you
yes,
listened?
It is, the first time.
Ah, how did you find out about us?
Well, my cousin told me.
That's great. Well, thank her, and thank you for listening. Andrew will be right with you. He'll take your information, and we'll be right back in just a moment on Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, and 103.5 FM HD2 with more Tech Talk. Stand by right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University. Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tysons Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge of Stratford University talking technology. Now let's talk about the physics of cooking a turkey.
Let's.
You know, we're just going to define this to be technology.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
well, it is, really.
It is. Cooking is really chemistry. That's a form of technology. Okay, first of all, you want to have a turkey that is juicy. You don't want it all dried out.
Right.
And it turns out that if you freeze a turkey, some of the cells break. And a turkey which has been frozen and then thawed is not going to be as moist as a turkey that has never been frozen, because you don't have that cellular breakage in where you know you lose some of your liquid.
Oh, so, okay. So go capture and kill your own turkey.
Yes,
that's
right.
Step
so
one,
you,
right.
So actually getting a fresh turkey that has never been frozen is you have a better chance of getting it moister.
Mm-hmm.
You can also inject some additional liquid into the skin. Sometimes people like to soak it for 24 hours in sort of a brine solution, and that also makes it moist. Now, the key, though, when you're cooking it is you want the white meat to be around 155 degrees Fahrenheit, and certainly no higher than 160 degrees Fahrenheit, because if it gets hotter than 160, it's dry.
Uh-huh.
It's too dry. So 155 would be well done, but still juicy. Now, on the other hand, the dark meat, which is tough, you want it to be cooked to about 180 degrees. Because Harold McGee, he's the food science guy. He actually writes the food science book that we use in our culinary arts program. He says when the leg meat is under 180 degrees, it's a little chewy, has kind of a metallic taste to it. So you'd really want it hotter.
Well, I'm more of a breast guy, so I don't know.
Well, then you would want to go for the 155.
Right.
Now here's the thing: the breast meat cooks faster than the leg meat. Which means that the white meat is done before the dark meat. And so you've got this problem. Now, many restaurants, what they do, they actually just cook the breast and the leg separately. They just take the bird apart. Hmm. But if you want to serve a nice turkey and you want to carve it on the table, you really can't cut it up before you cook it.
This is an interesting point.
So many restaurants just slice it and cook them separately.
Yeah.
There's no really point to keep it all together unless you're going to present the bird. Now, what Harold McGee recommends, and he does this. So, what you want to do? You want the white meat to cook slower. So, what he does? He puts ice packs on the breasts, on the white meat.
So, ice down your breasts. Okay,
that's right. He ices them down before and he makes certain that the turkey's fully thawed. If you have a frozen turkey,
right.
But I'm recommending not to get that. And so then what happens is that if you put ice on the turkey breast, they'll be about 40 degrees while the rest of the bird is around 60 degrees. And so since it is cooler than the rest of the bird, it turns out that the breast is going to cook a little slower, and it kind of evens it out. So that was the method that he uses. Now, other people just they might cover the breast in tin foil to try to keep, some of the heat out. That's one way to do it. And then you take the tin foil out when you want to brown it. So
interesting.
What some chefs do too, they actually cook the turkey upside down, and that tends to keep the juices on the breast, and so the whole idea is to try to keep it moist. So
probably doesn't look quite as pretty if you do it that way.
No, if you cook it upside down, it just doesn't look that nice when you flip it back up because it's not really brown.
Right.
So there's a few tricks from our food science guy to try to even out the cooking rates on the turkey.
Very interesting. That's sort of like icing it down. That's like addition by subtraction. If you knock that's clever.
Okay, let's talk about the GPS system at risk.
Okay.
Should we take a break or let's...
No, let's go ahead and do that, and then we'll take a break after this.
Okay, they had the fifth annual symposium on position, navigation, and time at Stanford University last week, and Professor Brad Parkinson, he's the father of GPS, is worried about threats to the effectiveness of the GPS system. And there are actually three enemies that are threatening the GPS system. And this is really important because this GPS system is used for so many things. I mean, your navigation system, it's used for for all kinds of tracking things. It's used for military purposes. We have become dependent on the GPS system. Aircraft use it. So we have become dependent on it, and if it goes down, we've got a problem. Turns out the next generation mobile broadband services are trying to get a piece of the electromagnetic spectrum that the GPS system is using, and that could actually jeopardize the GPS system. There are now cheap GPS jammers available that you can just buy for about $50 and put them in your car and just jam the GPS system. They're illegal, but people are using them, and I'll explain why. And then also solar storms, you can't do much about that, also affect GPS systems. Let's talk about this mobile broadband deal. There's a company called Light Squared, which has been endorsed by the Obama administration, and it's offering high bandwidth to cable customers across the country. And it's, you know, touting it to be the next generation wireless service. The problem is they want to use a piece of the spectrum that's very close to the GPS system. Now, the GPS system is a low-power system, easily subject to interference. And there's a huge battle that's been going on between LightSquared and the GPS community, and it's led to a series of tests. Now, LightSquared has some tests which they say shows that progress is being made in eliminating the interference, but Parkinson's challenges those conclusions and says actually the tests strongly indicate that LightSquared will, in fact, drown out GPS low-level signals. And he says this is a huge problem. Moreover, LightSquared has been running the test with only 1.5 kilowatt sources, and they're going to up it by a factor of 10 to 15 kilowatt, and says no tests have been done at that level. So they believe that if this system goes through, it's going to really damage GPS. Secondly, these consumer jammers. Now, drivers are buying these devices, which are illegal, in response to privacy concerns. Remember, we talked about a court case where police said they had the right to put a GPS tracker on your bumper if you were parked on a public road and they did not need to have a search warrant to do it. And they've actually won that case in the courts. It's now working its way up to the Supreme Court now. So consumers that want to make certain that they're not being tracked are buying these little $50 GPS jammers, and they just put them on their car, and then nobody can track them.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is they ruin the GPS for any devices that are near them. For instance, there was a GPS failure at Newark International Airport thanks to a passing driver who had a GPS jammer. So this is becoming quite a problem, actually.
If you've been through New York or New Jersey, you know the airport is right next to the turnpike. So
yeah,
this is an easy thing to do.
So that's a problem that they've got to deal with. And he didn't really have a solution to that because they are illegal. Probably we should simply go back and not allow the police to do tracking without, unless they do have a search warrant.
Right.
Now, as far as sunspots, any kind of major solar activity increases interference in the ionosphere, and that degrades GPS signals because, of course, the satellites are above the ionosphere, and then the signals have to penetrate it. And so this is particularly true at along the equator where the atmosphere is a little bit thicker. Now, there are signal processing solutions to these problems, so they think they can solve them technically. So that's kind of all you want to know about GPS and GPS tracking, and I think we got to watch this LightSquared deal closely.
Yeah. Yep. You're listening to Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. Stand by, more after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University. Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Since we started talking on the GPS systems and allocation of spectrum, let's talk about the politics of spectrum, because there's a lot that we need to watch here. As right now, you know, we've got the super committee working to cut down the deficit. We've got congressional technology committees searching for new money. And so there is this incentive to start having auctions and auctioning off any unused spectrum that's available. For instance, they want to, there's, you know, as we've, you know, as we reallocate the TV bands, that, you know, the movement from analog to digital TV means that there's additional space that's been no longer needed once you go to digital TV, and that creates extra spectrum that could be auctioned off. And so there may be an incentive to try to auction off this stuff to raise a few bucks. But actually, selling off all the spectrum just to raise dollars would threaten the future of wireless innovation in the U.S. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. We've really gone more to an open wireless model. See, our cell phones are closed wireless. In other words, your carrier has bought a particular spectrum, and only that carrier can use the spectrum. So it's closed to that one. And so that's what they're auctioning off the spectrum to people like Verizon or AT&T, who are just buying the spectrum for their cell phone operations. But the open wireless model, like Wi-Fi, is actually becoming more and more important. For instance, 90% of the data carried on tablets is carried over Wi-Fi. You know, when you've got these little tablets and they've got both a 3G connection as well as a Wi-Fi connection, well, it turns out about 90% of the data is really over Wi-Fi, mm-hmm. which is really an open spectrum which is available for that particular protocol. For iPhones, about 50% of the data is transferred over Wi-Fi, and the Android phones is catching up. And it makes sense that about a third of our usage is on the move, and so about a third of the usage is using the cellular connection, but the other two-thirds is using the open network. Now, there are also trends that are clear in other areas. We have now open spectrum available for Bluetooth, for RFIDs, which are used, you know, for paying tolls. We've got other systems used, like RFIDs are used like for the ExxonMobil Pass, MasterCard's PayPass, EasyPass. They all run on open wireless spectrum. Inventory management systems use RFID. That's like open wireless operations. And, in fact, the U.S. has a lot of smart grids operating in the U.S., smart electrical metering systems in the U.S., and these are all operating at the 900 megahertz area because in 1985, the FCC did something pretty clever. They actually put together what they, you know, several junk bands between 902 to 928 megahertz and made them into a contiguous band, and they made them actually open. And those were used for all kinds of medical devices. And so there's been a huge amount of innovation. So it's clear that the innovation going forward is going to be more in the open wireless area. And if we allocate all of our bandwidth because we want to auction it off to make a few bucks, we're going to really be hurting ourselves in the future as far as innovation. Well, it looks like we're coming close to the end of the show.
Yes,
it's always, always interesting. Now, listen, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu. And those will be forwarded to me, and we'll get to them on the show. We also would like you to go take a look at some of the Stratford University courses and programs. Go to stratford.edu. They're all right there. Of course, you can go to you can go and download any of the shows by going to techtalkonline.com, and you can listen to them anytime.
That's right. This show will replay tomorrow at 6 o'clock.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
We've got Navy football on the air today. They travel to San Jose to take on the Spartans at 4 o'clock, the kickoff. Toronto Maple Leafs against the Caps tonight. That begins at 7 o'clock. The puck drops. Nice day today. Sunny, high near 55. Right now, outside our studios in Northwest Washington, sunny skies, 41 degrees. It is 10 o'clock at Federal News Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers.